For Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, a new report says ordinary Iraqis angry at the occupation are a bigger threat than terrorists in Iraq. So why did Vice President Dick Cheney once again tie Iraq to Al-Qaeda?
25 years ago today, the Camp David Accord showed Middle East peace was possible under leaders like the late Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin.
Camp David proved that any problem can be solved if there is goodwill and understanding and some wisdom.
Also, federal officials are asking if drugs shipped from Canada are safe, but what about drugs shipped within the U.S.?
These stories and the idea of evil explored by writer Lance Morrow coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. Hurricane Isabel is swirling closer to the Outer Banks, and coastal residents along the Carolinas are getting out of the way of its path. The hurricane is moving about 9 miles an hour with sustained winds of 110 miles per hour toward the North Carolina coast. It's expected to make landfall sometime tomorrow. Meteorologist Stacy Stewart is with the National Hurricane Center in Florida.
Reconnaissance aircraft has been out there investigating the system, and along with that information, satellite imagery suggests that perhaps the weakening trend that we saw yesterday has perhaps stopped. We're also seeing an eye show up in the satellite imagery now, which suggests that it might be starting to get a little better organized. So we need to watch, and if the thunderstorms continue to wrap around the center and the eye becomes better defined, then we definitely have a hurricane that's on a strengthening cycle.
Stewart adds Isabel could cause flooding in many areas.
We're expecting somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 to 10 inches, and there can be locally higher amounts directly along the path of the hurricane. So areas that may have already received heavy rainfall or where rivers and creeks are near bankfull, they will easily overflow and create more flooding.
Coastal residents are boarding up homes and businesses. A state of emergency has been declared in Maryland, Virginia, and North Carolina. A new audio tape said to be carrying the voice of Saddam Hussein has surfaced on Arab television. On the tape, the speaker calls on Iraqis, both men and women, to join resistance fighters in their attacks on Americans in Iraq. The speaker says the defeat of U.S. troops is inevitable. The former U.N. chief weapons inspector says he believes Iraq got rid of most of its weapons of mass destruction a decade ago, but kept up the appearance of holding on to some of the weapons to prevent a military attack. Blix told an Australian radio station that it's unlikely American and British inspection teams will find any weapons of mass destruction, but they may find some interesting records. Retired General Wesley Clark is set today to become the 10th Democrat seeking his party's nomination for president. He scheduled a formal announcement this afternoon in Little Rock, Arkansas. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
Clark has fueled speculation for months about a possible run for the presidency. The former commander of NATO troops in Kosovo, a Rhodes Scholar, first in his class at West Point, Clark has also been an outspoken critic of President Bush and the war in Iraq. He's announcing his entry in the race just 4 months before the first caucus votes will be cast. Speaking today on NBC, he said it will be up to the voters to decide whether he's getting in too late.
Certainly, it's late in comparison to the other candidates. Other people have done it this late in the past. It really depends on the issues, on the candidates, on the field, and on the mood in the electorate.
Clark enters the race with little money or campaign organization, but as polls show, the public increasingly dissatisfied with President Bush's Iraq policy. Greg Allen, NPR News.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Industrials are up 15 points to 95.83 in moderate trade. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up 3 points to 1890. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, three former Merrill Lynch bankers turned themselves in to federal authorities today to face criminal charges stemming from a deal in 1999 between the two companies that helped Enron falsify books and records to the tune of $12 million. The phony bookkeeping allowed Enron to appear as if it met earnings targets. Daniel Bailey, James Brown, and Robert First were charged with fraud in a federal indictment unsealed today in Houston. All three are set to appear in court later today. The nation's second-largest cigarette maker is slashing its workforce. NPR's Debbie Elliott has more.
North Carolina-based R.J. Reynolds Tobacco plans to cut about 2,600 jobs, or 40% of its workforce, as the company tries to shore up profits. Chairman and Chief Executive Officer Andrew Schindler says RJR is fundamentally changing the way it operates its business and will trim expenses by $1 billion by the end of 2005. Competition from low-cost cigarette brands has hurt RJR's market share in recent years. Schindler says the firm will focus on promoting its premium brands, including Camel, Winston, and Salem, and place less emphasis on other brands. A spokesman says the job cuts will come in all areas of the company. Both blue and white-collar workers are affected. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
The chairman of several large public pension funds have called for New York Stock Exchange chairman Dick Grasso to step down, saying Grasso's $140 million compensation package was inappropriate for a regulator. The head of the California Public Employees Retirement System and the chief executive of the California State Teachers Retirement System are just some of those calling for Grasso's resignation. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces Naked in Baghdad, Anne Garrels' firsthand account of the war in Iraq as seen from inside Baghdad. Autographed copies are available at npr.org.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
There is news from Iraq today. Another tape, reportedly of Saddam Hussein, aired on Arab satellite TV. In it, he called on Iraqis to rise up against American troops. In Baghdad, the U.S. officer in charge of Iraqi detainees told reporters that six of them claim to be Americans, and two say they're British. The Defense Department hasn't confirmed if those claims are true. And according to intelligence reports leaked to the New York Times, most of the resistance in Iraq is not, as the Bush administration has been saying, the work of terrorists, but rather ordinary Iraqis angry about the lack of services and what they see as a U.S. occupation. This, in turn, points to increasingly mixed signals coming from the administration on Iraq and its relationship to global terrorism. Joining us on the line is David Sanger of the New York Times. And, David, your article today is titled, Iraqis' Bitterness is Called Bigger Threat Than Terror. It's something we've been hearing from reporters on the ground there. So what makes this new and compelling for you?
Well, what's interesting here is obviously the bombings are clearly the work of terrorists, Baathists, people, some many foreign fighters who've come in.
And yet we have to just point out that the Chicago Tribune is writing that there's been no forensic evidence that those major bombings, as you say, were made by the same people, implying that it's not organized.
There's no particular evidence of central command here, mm-hmm. though, that is not necessarily conclusive, because most of the explosives seem to have come from ordnance that was initially belonged to the mm-hmm. to the Iraqi government. But that raises the interesting next question, which is, how are they getting at this stuff? And part of the answer is that as the occupation wears on everybody, you end up having people who have some sympathies with these outside fighters who would like to see the United States leave. And so you're in a situation in which you have outsiders instigating, but they may be getting considerable help from a discontented populace.
And how does this contrast with what the administration's been saying?
Well, the administration's main line has been that the resistance has come mostly in the Sunni triangle, that is, that area around Tikrit to down through Baghdad, and that most of it has come from Baathists, dead-enders, in other words, people who are, you know, running this out to the end, and the foreign fighters who've been coming over the borders from Iran and from Syria. And there's obviously concern that Iraq has become a magnet for almost anybody who was discontented with the United States and, you know, has become a jihadist dream.
Well, it seems as if both Condoleezza Rice and Donald Rumsfeld are attempting to respond this week to comments by Vice President Dick Cheney, which he made on an appearance on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday. He said that the White House has learned more and more about a relationship between Iraq and al-Qaeda, and he cited the old intelligence of a meeting between one of the 9/11 hijackers and an Iraqi official, a meeting that everyone in the intelligence community has discounted.
That's right.
What's been the response to his appearance on that show?
It's been interesting and it's been mixed. And what the vice president did was raise a series of charges that were raised 2 years ago and that in many cases have been discredited. And what it does is it creates this impression, but no evidence, that Saddam Hussein was linked in some way to 9/11. And, of course, when you look at the poll data, some overwhelming number of Americans seem to believe that.
In fact, 70% of Americans believe Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11. Have officials this week also been responding to that completely inaccurate?
Yeah. You heard Rumsfeld say, when asked directly about this, he said, well, I don't have any evidence that he was linked to it. The White House also doesn't have any evidence linked to it. But they've also done very little to cut through this fog, because the president, when he gives his sort of normal campaign fundraising speech, talks about Iraq as a continuum of threats that began on 9/11.
You mentioned that Condoleezza Rice said to you that the terrorists are there now, definitely, having come post-war to Iraq. What do you think of Andrew Sullivan's writing on his web blog about the flypaper theory? That, in fact, this might have been by design. Gather them all in one place.
I haven't read what Mr. Sullivan wrote, but the president himself made this argument in his speech at the FBI Academy last Wednesday. And that argument is every terrorist who is in Iraq is not in the United States. Well, it's an interesting argument. It's a little bit of an ex post facto one, which is to say, it's almost meant to say, well, we intended for the terrorists to be drawn to the U.S. forces in Iraq. It's a little bit of a hard one to sustain when you still have, on average, 15 attacks on American forces each day in Iraq. And if we were able to sweep them up more quickly once they entered the borders in Iraq, it might be an argument, I think, that would have more currency.
Well, David, thank you very much.
Thank you. Always good to be here.
David Sanger, White House correspondent for The New York Times.
Twenty-five years ago today, in 1978, peace between Arabs and Jews became more than a dream. President Jimmy Carter, Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin, and Egyptian President Anwar Sadat signed the Camp David Accords.
We are privileged to witness tonight a significant achievement in the cause of peace, an achievement none thought possible a year ago, or even a month ago, an achievement that reflects the courage and wisdom of these two leaders.
Joining us on the line now to remember the 13 grueling days of Camp David is someone who was there, Samuel Lewis, ambassador to Israel at the time of the Accords. Welcome, Ambassador.
Hi, how are you?
Nice to have you. Ambassador, let's start with a personal note. These must have been some of the most tense and exhilarating days of your long and distinguished professional life. What do you remember most?
Well, I think I do remember the tension and the exaltation at the end. There were so many ups and downs. It was really a roller coaster. We were skeptical but hopeful. Then we were depressed. And finally, after the last inevitable crisis the night before and during the last day, suddenly it was done. And the minute we learned that the final deal had been struck between Carter and Begin and Sadat, the heavens opened up, and I've never seen a rain like it anywhere. It seemed to wash away all of our fears and depression for a little while anyway.
How was it made to work? I mean, it was so in so much trouble at one point that President Carter prepared a speech to the nation to say it hadn't worked. What was the smartest thing Carter did to make it work?
Well, he did several very smart things. I think one of the smartest things he did was to hold it in isolation at Camp David and actually force everybody to stay there, because had it been a place that was accessible to journalists during the meeting, the leaks and the indications of concessions being made or demanded would have made it politically impossible, I think, for Begin in particular, but also for Sadat, to sign off on some things that were very painful for them.
But Begin and Sadat missed the Mideast sun. They hated the peaceful, dark woods Carter loved.
Yeah, that's right. Although some of the delegation, particularly some of the Israeli delegation, really enjoyed it, playing tennis and walking the woods and so on.
Now, one thing Carter did was turn these very early on into what are called proximity talks. Begin and Sadat barely laid eyes on each other.
Well, they encountered each other occasionally in the woods and said hello. But it was a necessity. They were together three times early in the conference with Carter for several hours, and every time they came out angrier at each other. So he decided, actually with, I think, suggestions from some of the staffs on both sides, better to keep them apart and do it by going back and forth, shuttling back and forth between the leaders. There was really no or almost no interaction between the Israeli and Egyptian delegations either, though they were eating in the same dining room. They'd sit at different tables, and we could never get them to sit together, though we tried.
What were the issues? Let's review them. Many of them, of course, still issues.
Well, there were two major issues. One, was Sadat going to get the Sinai back? And was Israel going to have to give up all of its small settlements there and its airfields and totally evacuate?
The Sinai, of course, the desert between Israel and Egypt.
Yes, which had been acquired by Israel in the 67 war, which and also as the West Bank and Gaza had been occupied at the same time. So first, and I think foremost on Sadat's mind, was he going to get his land back and without any Israelis in it? Foremost on Begin's mind was he going to get a real peace treaty that did not in any way compromise his determination never to leave the West Bank? Begin was determined there would never be any independent state. He was determined that Israel would never leave the West Bank. So you had really a circle here to square, or a square to circle.
Mm. The Sinai did go back to the Egyptians. The settlements in the Sinai were taken down.
Right.
The principle of land for peace had been established. How important was that?
Well, that was very important. And this conundrum about how to move beyond autonomy to full withdrawal is still right in the middle of us today, only now it's in many ways more difficult. In 1978, there were 5,000 settlers only in the West Bank and 200 or 300 in Gaza. Now you have 220,000 settlers, huge lobby within the Israeli body politic. And to get them to withdraw from the West Bank now is in many ways far harder than it would have been then.
Ambassador, then, looking back a quarter of a century, what is the legacy of Camp David? Given the continuing violence between Israelis and Palestinians, what's the importance of Camp David?
Well, I think it's important on a number of grounds. One, it demonstrated that Israel can make peace with an Arab neighbor and that peace can hold, and the treaty has held very well. Though it's been a cold peace, for the most part, it's peace. Secondly, it demonstrates that a president of the United States, if he devotes himself wholeheartedly and doggedly to this problem, can in fact break obstacles that other people thought were impossible. It takes a lot of concentration, and Carter was unique in the amount he devoted to it until Clinton, who devoted almost as much energy and time, but unfortunately came up dry for another set of reasons. It also demonstrates that Arabs can be quite pragmatic even while talking very ideologically. And it also demonstrates that problems are resolvable when they're ripe for resolution, but not when they're not ripe. The Egyptian part of the Arab-Israeli conflict was ripe for resolution. And I think today the Palestinians are in such desperate shape, and the Israeli economy and society are so much in crisis after 3 years of violence, that there is a moment of ripeness now. The problem is you don't have the leaders on either side, either Arafat or Sharon, who are ready to make the kind of very far-reaching compromises of their positions that anybody would have to make. And we don't have a president either who's as determined to put his shoulder to the wheel and, regardless of the consequences, keep pushing until he achieves something.
Ambassador Samuel Lewis, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Samuel Lewis is former ambassador to Israel and a board member at the Institute of World Affairs in Washington, D.C.
Just ahead, a talk with Time Magazine's Lance Morrow about evil.
And later in the program, Canada's one thing, but how safe are mail-order drug prescriptions within the U.S.?
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
What is evil? Well, it's the absence of good, would be one obvious way to define it. But consider the great evil of 9/11. To some, to Osama bin Laden, for example, what happened that day was good. Well, Lance Morrow has written a new book called Evil, an Investigation. It is a meditation upon and struggle with the question of evil. And Lance Morrow joins me now in the studio. Welcome, Lance.
Thank you very much.
Why this subject? Why a book on evil?
It is one of the two or three most powerful words in the language. It is one of the deepest mysteries that, with which we live. So I think that anybody alive almost inevitably wonders about evil, and particularly in the face of these cases that we see from time to time, when we see something horrific happen and we say, well, is that evil? What exactly is it? How do we evaluate this?
So, Lance, is there a universal evil that anyone would know right away in its presence?
I think that evil likes complexity, and it likes smoke and mirrors and that kind of thing. I favor Hannah Arendt's idea, which she said, I think of evil not as profound but as shallow and very, very lethal. And I think of it as a fungus, as a kind of fungus. And that's the way I think of it. I think of it as an infection, a kind of cancer, something that wanders and may infect perfectly nice people from time to time. For example, the Hutu in Rwanda in 1994 with machetes slaughtered 800,000 Tutsi in 2 months, which was evil work. And yet I venture to say that if you went and talked to these people today, you might say to yourself, well, they seem so ordinary. Mm-hmm. And yet they did great evil.
Evil belongs entirely to the symmetry and dynamic of human life and is even indispensable to it, you're right, at one point.
Mm-hmm.
We can't be who we are unless it's part of the wheel of life. And in fact, no good without evil.
I think we live in the struggle of good and evil. And in fact, our good is accomplished through the struggle with evil. And all history.
So evil's not all bad?
Well, see, there again. I think one can play with words in paradoxes in that way. I think we live when you're talking about evil, you're talking about paradox,
and we're fascinated by it too, aren't we? One thing I found happening to me as I read your book was, I was waiting for the next anecdote about something really evil someone had done.
Well, I tried to tell a lot of stories in the book because I believe that evil is always a story.
You recount at a party meeting a man, now somewhat elderly, who remembered what he had done. He had shot German prisoners that he'd captured in the back of the head.
Yeah.
And he didn't feel bad about it.
No, this was a man in his late 70s, I guess. And when he was a kid, I guess he was 18 or 19, and he was leading a squad between the lines or out way in front of the American lines in France just toward the end of the war as they were going across toward Germany, and they captured eight German very, very young kids. I mean, you know, Hitler was using kids at that point. And He didn't know what to do. And they had been through terrific combat, and they, you know, the unit had been chewed up by combat and so on. And they couldn't let them go, but they couldn't they didn't have the manpower to take them prisoner and lead them back. And they investigated other possibilities. And then finally, he's lined them up against the bank of a river, and he and his men executed them all. And I devote a lot of time in my book to talking about whether or not this was an evil act and how we should evaluate this.
But you don't define evil. After you read the 200 or so pages of your book, there's no climactic chapter where you say, well, I've looked at it and I've figured it out and this is how I define it.
I think that evil is a mystery. I think that mysteries cannot be defined. What you can do is talk about them. You can describe them. You can describe their work, their effects. We can agree that it is difficult for everyone to agree on what evil is. And we can agree that it is possible to tie yourself in knots by saying, well, one man's good is another man's evil and so on, and to have these cross-cultural switchbacks and mirror effects. But it seems to me that that is ultimately not adequate, that there is such a thing as evil. No one can look at the 20th century without being aware of a tremendous amount of evil which occurred.
In studying and meditating on and struggling with evil, as you did, Lance mm-hmm. Morrow, in this book, did you discover a way we might diminish it in the world?
Obviously, the way to diminish evil in the world is, among other things, tolerance, understanding, a civilized, decent standard of behavior with other people, and but also a recognition that evil must be opposed. This is very important. You must oppose evil. You can't simply say to understand everything is to forgive everything, and they have their way, and I have my way. Well, the Nazis had their way.
So you wrote a book about evil. Why didn't you write a book about good? Would you have been as provoked?
As a matter of fact, I have thought a lot about that, and I think I might do that because good is a very interesting subject. Good is a fascinating subject, but I sometimes think that the opposite of evil shouldn't be characterized as good. I think it should be either hope, which is a much more dynamic thing in our minds than good, or it should be love, which is not in some gooey way, but in an absolute way. The strongest force against evil is love, I believe.
Lance Morrow, thank you very much for joining us on
Thank
this.
You.
Lance Morrow is the longtime Time magazine essayist and writer and author of the new book, Evil, An Investigation.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a controversial architect uses the ruins of war to build discos and restaurants in Beirut.
And fiddler extraordinaire Natalie McMasters. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, mail-order drugs. Is anyone making sure they're safe when they arrive at your doorstep?
And In Cold Blood, a 40-year-old mystery about blood platelets is solved.
It's Fashion Week in New York City. We'll talk to a designer who's dressed the characters on Sex and the City about her new runway show.
And ethnic food surprises, including the founder of Chungking Foods.
There's a line in his autobiography where he says, "Only in America would it be possible for a man with a name like Gino Francesco Pellucci sign up poor Italian immigrants to get rich selling Chinese food."
These stories coming up Here and Now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. The crowded field of candidates for president is about to expand. Retired General Wesley Clark is expected to become the 10th Democrat to enter the race. The former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO says his experience sets him apart from the other candidates.
In terms of elective politics, certainly I don't have that. But in terms of dealing with diplomacy, with the politics of how to get things done, how to get legislation through Congress, every senior officer in the armed forces has had some experience in that. I've dealt with lawmakers on both sides of the House. I've dealt with members of the executive branch for years.
Clark, who spoke on NBC's Today Show this morning, is expected to formally announce his candidacy today in Little Rock, Arkansas. Hurricane Isabel is fast approaching, moving north-northwest at a fairly good clip, according to at least one expert. Meteorologists expect her to hit the North Carolina coast tonight. Ed Rappaport, the National Hurricane Center, says the storm continues to have winds of up to 110 miles per hour.
Isabel is now centered about 450 miles offshore of the North Carolina Outer Banks and following a track that will take it there on Thursday. However, tropical storm force winds will arrive along the coast by midnight tonight.
About 100,000 people have been evacuated in anticipation of the high winds, giant sea swells, and rain. Isabel is the biggest storm to hit the region since Hurricane Floyd in 1999. Another audio tape purportedly from Saddam Hussein has surfaced. Broadcast by the Arab language station Al Arabiya, the voice says the loss of U.S. troops is eating away at U.S.-led forces. It calls on Iraqis to step up their fight against the occupiers. The voice resembled Hussein's, but there is no immediate way to know if it is in fact authentic. Yasser Arafat has dismissed the U.S. veto of a U.N. resolution against Israel's threat to expel him. The Palestinian leader says the U.N. vote may be interpreted as a green light for Israel to move against him. The U.S. says it opposes removing Arafat from the West Bank, but criticizes the resolution for not condemning terrorist attacks against Israel. Meanwhile, Israel has rejected a ceasefire offer from the militant group Hamas. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 21 points at 95.89, and the Nasdaq is ahead 6 at 18.93. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Importing prescription drugs from Canada is illegal, but is it unsafe? Or, for that matter, less safe than buying drugs via mail order within the United States? That some shipments of drugs from Canada might not be as safe as they should be seems to have been demonstrated last month when a federal sting operation in Springfield, Massachusetts, uncovered a shipment of unrefrigerated and possibly unsafe insulin from Canada. But nonprofit groups say the federal authorities have not shown as much interest in whether mail-order drugs in the U.S. are safe. Joining us is John Rector, General Counsel for the National Community Pharmacists Association in Virginia. Hi, John.
Glad to be here.
John, for many people, buying drugs online from painkillers to insulin is a, you know, very standard way of getting their medication. Is it safe?
Well, I think it's always a relative situation, but we were somewhat surprised that the Food and Drug Administration would make such a big deal out of one vial of insulin that didn't have the proper temperature. And we find throughout the country that kind of situation occurring on a daily basis. I would have been shocked if the story recently was FDA conducts sting on domestic mail order companies. That would have been a real breakthrough to help American consumers to get to the bottom of the unsafe mailing that's happening domestically.
Well, what do you make of this paradox then? Much ado being made of this unrefrigerated insulin, and yet many other instances of problems with mail order have not been dealt with by the FDA.
Well, in the Canadian situation, it's obviously is very political. And frankly, this isn't just about insulin. I think all prescription drugs need to be kept in a certain appropriate temperature range. The technology is available. I know there are chips that can be placed conveniently in shipments, but there's been very little positive response from the federal government.
Well, a study by the U.S. Pharmacopeia showed that one in four mail-order prescription packages mailed in the United States is exposed to excessive heat. Yet they say they've encountered resistance in their attempt to institute new rules and standards. So, again, I ask, what's going on?
There basically are four companies. They're called Pharmacy Benefit Managers, PBMs. They provide 90% of the mail order prescriptions in the U.S., and they're very influential. They're particularly influential with the current Bush administration, and I imagine they have been able to discourage the administration from taking appropriate steps that relate to their very profitable mail order business.
John, what protection do consumers have in this country for the mail order drugs that they buy domestically?
There's very little protection. The mail order pharmacies are licensed to do business in the state where the facility is. The pharmacists that they employ are not licensed in the state where the consumer is. And in effect, the consumer is disenfranchised. Like, for example, let's say in Springfield, rather than from Canada, it came from a Medco facility in Tampa, Florida. And the insulin was frozen or bubbly when you received it. The state board and the officials in Massachusetts are going to tell the consumer they don't have jurisdiction. The consumer will call Florida, and they'll tell the consumer that they have jurisdiction only in Florida.
John, do you see any change on the horizon?
Well, I think in an ironic way, this very narrow focus on importing Canadian drugs may in fact lead to the FDA and others having to look more carefully and responsibly at the domestic marketplace.
Well, John Rector, thanks very much for joining us on this.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you. John Rector is General Counsel for the National Community Pharmacists Organization. He joined us from Alexandria, Virginia.
And tomorrow we'll hear from the Food and Drug Administration about what they say is being done to monitor safety in mail-order drug delivery. Well, new medical research holds out the promise of making a part of the blood supply safer and easing the chronic shortage of the blood cells called platelets. The transfusion of platelets saves lives every day, enabling normal coagulation and clot formation in people who lack the disc-shaped cells. But platelets, gathered from blood donors, have a short shelf life because unlike red blood cells, platelets can't be refrigerated. They last only about 5 days before bacterial growth renders them dangerous, and refrigeration actually makes them useless. Until now, no one knew why that was. But research published in the current issue of Science explains the problem and sets out a potential solution. The author of that paper is Tom Stossel of Harvard Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Hello, Tom.
Hello.
Well, first of all, tell us, how big a problem is this short shelf life of platelets?
Well, it is a big problem. The blood services industry, which provides platelets, really does a very good job of providing platelets under great strain, but the strain is because of the short five-day shelf life of platelets. And you hear that on holidays and weekends that there's great urgency to get people to come in and donate platelets because fewer people donate at those times, and that's when the shortages arise.
And just remind us briefly, are these used mainly for people who have chronic illness, or is it an acute need for platelets?
It's both. About two-thirds of platelets are used for patients undergoing treatment for cancer because the cancer chemotherapy destroys platelets. About a third of the or a quarter of platelets go to patients undergoing major surgery or after major trauma because that depletes platelets as well.
Right. So your first discovery is about what happens to make platelets useless when you refrigerate them. Tell us, why is that?
Well, this was first discovered about 40 years ago when the technology of platelet transfusion was developed, that if you transfused refrigerated platelets into people, they disappeared. And this was a great ugly surprise because, you know, you would hope your lunch is refrigerated, and led to this problem of bacterial growth. And in the past couple of years, we discovered that in the cold, platelets become recognized by the immune system that clears them out.
Ah. So, in other words, well, the liver, for instance, that would have that job is essentially filtering the platelets out of the blood.
That's correct.
So you have to look for a way to hide the platelets from the liver.
That's absolutely correct.
And what is that?
Well, we drilled down to exactly what it was on the chilled platelet that made the liver interested in it. And it turned out that on all our cell surfaces, there are sugars. Sugars like little beads on a string that are very important in immune recognition. It's a very complicated process. Mm-hmm. So we identified the specific sugar that was recognized by the liver after chilling and devised a way to cover it up.
So the liver was recognizing the platelets by this sugar bead that's on it, and you just covered it up with another sugar bead.
Exactly.
Well, this work that you've done, you did in mice. How confident are you that it's going to work in people too?
Well, we showed that if you transfused chilled platelets that we've modified the sugar on in mice, they circulate beautifully. And we've shown in test tubes that if you take human platelets and modify them in the same way, they're not recognized by immune cells. So we're reasonably confident that it should work in humans. It has to be tested, though.
Do you have a time frame?
Well, I hope in the next few years.
Well, thank you very much for telling us about your work.
Well, thank you, Robin.
Professor Tom Stossel of Harvard Medical School and Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. His work on platelets is published in the current issue of Science.
You're listening to Here and Now. The 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Under the Law Amendment, was intended to give free slaves citizenship. Part of it reads, "No state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws." Well, today, the 14th Amendment is being ratified in the state of Ohio. That's right, today, Ohio Constitution Day. The state had ratified the amendment in the mid-1800s, but after just a year, rescinded it after opponents labeled it contrary to the best interest of the white race. Well, Jack Sims is a student at the University of Cincinnati Law School. He's one of a number of students who've led the charge to re-ratify the 14th Amendment in Ohio. We talked to him yesterday.
The 14th Amendment was ratified by enough states for it actually to become law of the United States, so it is law of the United States. However, since the state of Ohio rescinded its ratification of the amendment in 1868, Ohio's last official record is on the books as being against, if you will, the 14th Amendment.
Well, most Ohioans were probably not even aware of this. How did awareness come of this?
The project actually had sort of a funny start. One of my professors came to me with Title I of the United States Code, which has the Constitution in it, and we looked at the 14th Amendment, and in it, it said listed, it had the ratifications listed of the states, these states ratified in these states. And from the class, turned into this project to get the amendment re-ratified in Ohio.
And it turned out to be a little bit more than just a kind of historical glitch. There were some serious problems as a result of Ohio not having ever formally ratified the 14th Amendment, right? Like attracting hate groups.
Well, a lot of groups, extremist groups, have said, and I suppose continue to say, that the 14th Amendment is you know, not really part of U.S. law. And one of the things they cited for that was Ohio's rescission.
Give me the process just briefly, and how complicated to re-ratify, if you will, the 14th Amendment in Ohio.
Well, what we needed to do, you know, eventually the goal was to get the assent of the legislature. And through our contacts at the university, we were able to speak with State Senator Mark Mallory and State Representative Gary Cates, and they were actually very helpful. They came and met with us, and they got the political process going. And, in fact, earlier this year, the Ohio legislature did ratify the amendment, and now on Ohio Constitution Day, they will be transmitting the ratification of the amendment to the United States government.
Jack, how are you and your fellow law students feeling about making a little bit of history?
Well, as a student, I think this is one of the things that's most exciting. You know, we a professor brought something to our attention, and we got some work on it, and you know, we actually got some change effected through the political process, and you know, it says good things about, you know, first of all, representative democracy, that normal people can contact their legislators and get something like this done. And secondly, as a law student studying this type of thing in particular, you know, I think it's pretty exciting for us to be able to, you know, make some difference in the law and to you know, help out a little bit.
Yeah. Well, Jack Sims, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Jack Sims is a student at the University of Cincinnati. He's one of the leaders of a now successful move to re-ratify the 14th Amendment in Ohio. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The United States is a melting pot, but not only of people. It's also a banquet of the foods Americans brought with them from where they came from. Not that it always makes sense. The man who popularized Chinese food here had about as much connection to China as, well, let's let Joel Denker explain, along with many other surprises he's cooked up about American food in his new book, The World on a Plate, a tour through the history of America's ethnic cuisine. And Joel Denker joins us in the studio. Welcome, Joel.
Nice to see you.
It's almost a truism, isn't it, that America's a nation of immigrants, and immigrants bring the foods of their country with them. What inspired you to go on this particular ethnic tour of food?
It's actually been an adventure that's been a long time germinating. I've always been passionately interested in food and also how food reflects the cultures from which it came. I guess like a lot of Americans, I took all of the cornucopia of international food for granted. And I didn't ask myself questions. For example, one of the foods I talk a lot about, Colombo yogurt, I remember when I first saw it in the early 70s, if someone had asked me where it came from, I couldn't have told you what I now discovered and wrote about in the book, that it was created by an Armenian family in Andover, Massachusetts.
Which makes perfect sense.
Right. I might have said that it was Italian, or which would have made no sense. Italians don't have a great affinity for yogurt.
What about the Dove Bar?
Yeah, the Dove Bar is interesting because that comes out of a business that Greek immigrants were pretty strongly concentrated in Chicago, but began to spread around to many small towns. Greeks opened up candy shops, and one of the shops in Chicago, the family involved started experimenting. As one of them said, I kept dipping ice cream into strong chocolate, and this emerged, and the Dove Bar is history.
You know, you did a wonderful thing today. You brought some food from Boston's Chinatown, some wonderful scallops.
Scallops, which are actually called spicy and salty scallops.
Which they are.
Fried with lots of little pieces of green and red chili. And this is sort of a new, to me, these are kind of new items that kind of have come in with the new Hong Kong and Cantonese immigrants who've come to Boston and other cities in the last 20, 25 years.
Now, of course, you've been able to get Chinese food in the average American
sure.
home for some time, perhaps most famously, Chongqing, which was, of course, started by a Chinese immigrant to the United States, right?
No. Yeah, this is a story I certainly didn't know, and I'm not sure I can remember. It's like a lot of things I found out in the book, there were tidbits. Actually, a friend of mine mentioned it to me a long time ago and said, "Do you know who Gino Pelucci is?" And I really didn't. And, you know, Gino Pelucci was the creator of Chongqing chow mein and chop suey and then later frozen foods. He was a guy who, from a very early age, was selling something, whether it was pieces of coal or whatever. And in the late 40s, he had been trying to sell dehydrated garlic on the road, which didn't really work. And there's only, as he said, there's only so many people want to buy that. And he was in St. Paul, Minneapolis area, and came across some Japanese who were growing bean sprouts. And kind of got intrigued and thought, you know, maybe these were saleable. He'd been able to sell a lot of things in his young days. So he started asking them to help him learn how to grow some. Grew some in some bathtubs without great success, experimented. Finally started packaging them in little plastic bushels and selling them to restaurants. And there's a line that in his autobiography where he says, "Only in America would it be possible for a man with a name like Gino Francesco Pelucci, son of poor Italian immigrants, to get rich selling Chinese food." It's kind of uniquely American as you find these people like Pelucci who are immigrants but who grab on to something different. One good example is was a German guy in Texas outside San Antonio named William Gephardt, who was one a number of people feel invented chili powder. Or Greeks with the Coney Island, you know, who in the Midwest, Detroit area, Chicago, do these Coney Island stands of the hot dogs with the chili sauce. But it's interesting. It's not just chili sauce. It's chili sauce with an infusion of some Greek spices.
Does it kind of bring us together as a people that we eat off each other's plates,
yeah,
as it were?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they're, in a way, the book's sort of a celebration of the melding together of food is almost symbolic of the, you know, kind of the diversity of the society.
Thank you, Joel Denker.
Thank you.
Joel Denker is the author of The World on a Plate, a tour through the history of America's ethnic cuisine.
If you wear clothing, and most of us do, you are making a fashion statement. What that statement is often hard to discern, but it's your billboard to the world. Well, this week, models and designers from around the world have come to New York to declare their fashion statements with the fervent hope that someone will notice. It's Mercedes-Benz Fashion Week. It comes just 2 years after the terrorist attacks threw the fashion industry into a major economic and emotional slump. Designer Nanette Lepore joined us on the line from her boutique in downtown New York, where she's readying her line. Hi, Nanette.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. I just want to have touched on this topic just quickly. 2 years ago, Fashion Week was canceled because of the events of 9/11. Did you have to react to 9/11? Obviously, there's an emotional reaction, but did you have to change your line or react in that way?
Oh, yeah. It definitely affected my color palette. Things that were bright and cheerful just looked very wrong, and all the colors were toned down with, like, grays and bright colors were thrown into tea to sort of get them more subtle, or color remover was used a lot for the last couple of years. Things had a more somber feel.
But there's one dress in particular that you didn't toned down that much at all. You're one of the designers for Sex and the City, which is the hit HBO show about several female friends, their love lives, and their shoes. And, you know, after 9/11, a lot of people wondered if they would dress more somberly, and it didn't seem as if they did. There's one dress in particular that Carrie wore.
That was actually the opening look for that 9/11 show. It was a really bright rainbow striped dress. At that point, we were in it. You know, the show was set to go, so the show went on with that dress in it.
Well, that's so interesting that that wasn't a fashion statement, because I thought maybe Carrie was making a statement of hope and optimism and rainbows. But at any rate, sum up for us, if you will, the kind of fashion statement you want to make on the runway.
Well, I've got the bold, bright colors have returned, and nothing is washed out. Nothing is thrown into tea and wrinkled up. Everything is bright and crisp and pressed, and colors are popped with, like, acid limes and hot pinks.
And they're short.
I know. When you do a show, it's about theater. It's not just about selling clothing. So in the case with my line, it's more about putting out there my colors, my fabrics. It's making it look extra super-duper cute for the presentation of it.
Nanette, before we let you go, some other things you see on the fashion horizon. I'm noticing a lot of turtlenecks under little jumpers and over-the-knee black socks.
I know. We had a lot of layering, and that's still going on, but in a more cleaned-up way. Mm-hmm. Less of a vintage look and more of a modern look, but still the individual comes through.
Well, Nanette, I do that layered thing, too. I wear my gray hooded sweatshirt everywhere.
I know. It's cute. Then you can put that on with your fabulous dress, and you look extra chic.
I am so fashion-forward.
Yes. You have to have that with your high heels and your cocktail dress.
Nanette Lepore, thank you so much.
Thank you.
What will you send your models down the runway to? What music will you play?
It's actually one song. What's the song about Carrie's mother? Oh, Stacy's mom. Who's the band? We love the one Stacy's mom's got it going on.
Fountains of Wayne?
Because, see, I'm in the mom range now. You know, Stacy's mom's got it going on.
I think it's Fountains of Wayne.
Oh, okay. You know who it is. Then.
Well.
Good. See? I'm so out of it.
Nanette, thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
New York fashion designer Nanette Lepore. For more information, check out our website at here-now.org.
Stacy's mom has got it going on. Stacy, can I come over after school? After school. We can hang around by the pool.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Kako, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog. Our web producer is Zach Christo. And our interns are Ann Stevenson and Ed Walter.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again. Here and Now.
Can't you see? Stacy's mom has got it.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.
A controversial architect uses the ruins of war to build restaurants and discos in Beirut.
And fiddler extraordinaire Cape Breton's Natalie McMasters.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.